Welcome to the Bike Show with me, Jack Thurston. This week on the show, we'll be hearing a gripping story, a true story that took place at the height of the Cold War. It's a tale of young love and bike racing, of political ideology and state surveillance, set in a Europe recovering from the catastrophe of World War. In a recording of a live event held as part of the Cycle Screen Bike Film Festival at the Watershed Cinema in Bristol, I talked to author Herbie Sykes about his highly acclaimed book, The Race Against the Stasi. Welcome to Watershed. I am Jack Thurston. I present The Bike Show, which is a radio programme that began life on Resonance FM in London, but now exists chiefly as a podcast produced from Abergavenny in South Wales, where I now live, and I've brought the weather with me today, so I'm sorry about that. It doesn't actually always rain in Wales, but often it does. And so I should also, in addition to welcoming everybody in the room, welcome the listeners on the podcast, because this is being recorded subject to technological success. So over the decade or more of making The Bike Show, the approach that I've taken to cycle sport has really been a kind of bait and switch operation, I think. I kind of lure listeners in with the bike racing, but then try and divert them as soon as I can to think about what I believe to be the bigger issues, whether it's social change, technology, politics, or culture. And so when Tommy asked me to do this session with Herbie, I was absolutely happy to do it, because I think Herbie, though he is much more of a bike racing nut than I am and much more knowledgeable about the sport than I am, I think his underlying approach of bait and switch is kind of the same. Another way of looking at it is that when Herbie writes about cycling, he's not always writing about cycling, if that makes any sense. And sometimes he's writing about Marmite.
Yes.
But that's another story. But Herbie lives in Italy and has made his name with a trio of books about Italian bike racing, but often looking at the sport as a looking glass into another world, social, cultural, political issues, and never overlooking the human stories that are ultimately what makes a successful story and a successful, readable, compelling book. His fourth book, The Race Against the Stasi, was published to widespread acclaim from readers and also from his peers among other sports writers. And I had this clever idea at the end of last year to do to ask all the sports writers I knew who write about cycling to nominate their favourite cycling book of the year, and we'd have a kind of relay. So the first one would nominate their favourite, and then I'd get the author of that book to nominate their favourite, and we'd go around handing the baton from one writer to the next, and we'd cover all the great books out that year so that people could do their Christmas shopping. But it immediately failed because everybody chose The Race Against the Stasi. So it was kind of a relay race that, I don't know, everyone handed the baton to Herbie. So it's a terrific book that tells the story of a German bike racer by the name of Dieter Wiedemann, who's not a household name in cycling, at least in this country, by any means. Yet Wiedemann was the first bike racer to compete in the two biggest bike races of his times, the Peace Race in Central Europe and the Tour de France. Now, that might sound like a useful bit of pub quiz cycling knowledge, but it conceals a much bigger story, and that is the story of this book. Was that the thing that first drew you to look at Dieter Wiedemann in more detail? Because you had been doing a series of stories the Peace Race.
I'd always been fascinated by the Peace Race. For any of you that don't know the Peace Race, it was a kind of a Tour de France of the East, or it was perceived or portrayed as a Tour de France of the East. And essentially, it was a stage race that ran between Berlin, Warsaw, and Prague each year. So it happened behind the Iron Curtain, and ergo, we in the West knew very little about it. It was fundamentally different from the Tour de France. It was colossal. It was much bigger as regards the public engagement with it. It was much bigger than ever the Tour de France was. I mean, we're talking about millions of people, vast seas of people, huge stadiums, 200,000 people in Prague, for example, routinely saw the stage there. So the Peace Race was a huge sporting event, but also deeply politicised, as everything was in that world. It wasn't commercially driven, there were no sponsors. The idea was that the cyclists were couriers of peace. They would disseminate the message of peace in this post-war Europe, which had been decimated, very obviously. It was a huge event, albeit we knew very little about it in the West. Ultimately, it, like every, because it was, everything in that world was politicized, it soon degenerated or evolved, and the message changed somewhat. The message became that only socialism could deliver peace, and that the West, America's serfs, were determined to undermine peace in Europe. So it was a deeply, very interesting socially, culturally, politically, and Dieter, by an accident of birth, found himself in socialist Germany. He grew up in Chemnitz, or Karl Marx Stadt, as it was known at the time. And of course, like all German boys, his ambition was to ride the peace race, because the peace race was the biggest annual sporting event in the world, bar none.
A big bike race, a big road race, put on by newspapers,
yes,
with an ideological component to it of nation building, or at least solidarity amongst nations.
Sure.
That's not that far away from how the Grand Tours emerged in Italy and France, is it?
Cycling has always been, you know, like all organised sport, it's conditional upon and conditioned by politicians. It was ever thus. I think the difference here is that it was selling an ideology. It was absolutely unequivocal. You know, you've got these three war-torn nations, and fascism had devastated the continent. So they were trying to build an alternative to fascism. We'd lived through two great wars in Europe, and so the message was we need to build a new way to live, a new ideology, a new methodology, because if we don't, the inevitable consequence of capitalism is this, and capitalism contaminates sport. So the whole thing was ideologically driven.
And why cycling?
Originally, they'd thought about doing it with boxing, but boxing as a metaphor for peace amongst is not the very best. Cycling is perfect, because the cyclists are the couriers of peace. So they're through the towns and villages of Central Europe, they're delivering a message of peace and of hope, you know, ultimately. So cycling was the perfect vehicle. Certainly more so than boxing.
This is where we have to untangle a little bit. Although it's all about friendship and love and sharing peace, it's a contest.
Yeah.
And maybe you can take that into what the German Democratic Republic felt that sport could do for the German Democratic Republic.
Probably already begin to understand it's quite complicated, the peace race, ideologically. Essentially, the German Democratic Republic was unusual in the sense that it was a new country. It wasn't formed until 1949 yet. And part of the process, and they to engender or to create patriotism amongst 18 million, 17 million Germans. And they needed to put ideological distance between themselves and the war, what had predicated, if you like, creation of the state. And sport was always very important for ideologically, because sport engenders patriotism. It's absolute, it's unequivocal. And the peace race was the first sporting event, international sport, major sporting event, to take place in East Germany, in the DDR. The DDR was effectively a pariah state. The IOC wanted nothing to do with it, and by extension, the capitalist states, the capitalist world, wanted nothing to do with it. So the peace race was very important. It sat outside of the sphere of the IOC. It was ostensibly an amateur race. It wasn't a professional race. And bike racing was extremely popular. So it was a very important tool politically in the first instance, because it bestowed legitimacy upon the state. And then, fairly early on, a very famous East German rider started to win the thing, a guy called Teve Schorr. And he was a socialist. He was a card-carrying socialist, an absolute believer. Yeah, and Teve's success was the success of the workers' and peasants' state. Yeah, so it was owned by everybody. He was, if you like, the sporting symbol of socialism's great victory. So the whole thing is wrapped up in ideology and in an ideological war. There's a war going on, yeah, between the East and West. And the other thing with regard to the nation, the fact that it was run as it wasn't contaminated by commercial interests, the basic premise was anybody can come. If you've got a bike and a team, come. Any nation could ride the peace race in principle. So you'd teams from Egypt, for example. There was famously a team from India who were under the impression they were going to ride a cycling festival. Six Indian riders, I think four of them certainly were Sikhs, were told they were going to Europe to ride a cycling festival. What they were actually going to do was to ride a really brutal two-week stage race. And these poor guys had never ridden a bike race before. They'd ridden a bike, but they'd no idea. And there are lots of stories about Egyptians who've never seen snow before. And in the Harz Mountains in the spring, you get snow. Yeah. So the idea, anybody could come. And in so doing, they were subscribing indirectly to socialism.
Back to our hero, Dieter Wiedemann. He's born into a father who is a keen, interested cyclist, racing cyclist, or...
No, just a cycling family.
Just a cycling family. Sure. And it quickly becomes apparent, as it always seems to in these stories, that the genetics are the most important predetermining factor of cycling talent, and he's quite good. Mm. How do you get on as a cyclist, a racing cyclist in 1950s German Democratic Republic? How does that differ from elsewhere?
That's a good question. Blimey. Cycling was very, very big. Off the Teve Shaw, the character that I made mention of before, was a megastar. And so cycling was still more popular, his success. In the same way that you know, Wiggins, Cavendish have conditioned the cycling boom in Britain. It was ever thus with sport. The great champions can generate interest, and so it goes on. Same with Boris Becker, Steffi Graf in Germany, etc. Cycling was very, very popular, and there were very few sports. So you pretty much did cycling or football, I think, or maybe gymnastics. There was, at that time in the 50s, everything was organised. All of sport was organised by the party through its various organs. You had to ride a certain bike with a certain gear ratio, etc., etc. This was socialism. And ultimately, he joined the sports club. In much the same way, you know, I mean, there's no fundamental difference. He was a talented guy and progressed through the ranks and ultimately came to represent his country in the peace race. And the peace race was the absolute pinnacle of sporting achievement. Probably more so than any football. In the 50s and 60s, certainly. The peace race was such a big race. I mean, it's very difficult even for me to try and articulate the scale of the thing and just how important it was. But Dieter progressed and rode the peace race in 62 and again in 64.
And was rewarded for success by the state. What was life like for an elite athlete in the German Democratic Republic?
Everything in that world was conditioned by your relationship with the party and with socialism. Okay, so as an athlete or an artist or whatever, anybody in public life, your ability to get on in any form of life, in point of fact, was conditioned by your relationship with the ideology or how the party perceived you. Did you play the game? Dieter's family were apolitical. They weren't political people at all. But you've got to play the game. You've got to be seen to vote early. You've got to be seen to say the right things or not say the wrong things. So everything was conditioned by that. All through the book and all through his Stasi file, at every turn, there are reports about his suitability to ride, to represent the country, simply because he's representing socialism. He's not just representing a country per se. He's representing the ideology. So... he learned to keep his mouth shut. That was his, like a lot of East German people, you learn to say nothing.
So he has these initial successes, but two things emerge in the middle of the book, which is that he's fallen in love,
yes,
with a girl from West Germany, the Federal Republic, which is a forbidden love. But he also seems that he stops getting the breaks in terms of the racing that he would have hoped to get. And these two things seem to happen at the same time, and they both contribute, I felt, to his decision to defect. And we're not going to go into the defection moment, because that's a moment of high drama that is best discovered in the book.
There are a number of issues. He met a girl just prior to them building the Berlin Wall. So the girl had family in his hometown. And so each summer she would come on holiday to his hometown. And they met, and he liked her and she liked him and those things. And this was in 1960. They met in 1960. They became pen friends. And they're kind of discovering themselves. She's in the West. He's in the East. But it's like a teenage love affair, you know. And they were finding their way. Then, of course, in 61, they build the Berlin Wall. So through the letters that they're writing, dreaming of being together, discovering that who they're going to be, maybe their sexuality, I don't know. But this thing is taking its course. And then, of course, and they can write letters. It's not prescribed, but it's not, contact with the West contaminates socialism, but you can do it. You know, it's just about accepted as long as you don't exaggerate. 61, the wall goes up, and that's it then. They're never going to be together. Because there is a wall now. But of course, at the same time, they're teenagers, and so they're rebelling against everything, yeah? And they're one of the ways in which they rebelled was to continue to write the letters, yeah? Because the parents said you shouldn't do it. It wasn't good. It created suspicion. So they continue to write the letters and continue with this dream of being together, of escaping their own lives, if you like. As regards Dieter's being unable to ride all of the races that he wanted, he wasn't a particularly good socialist. He wasn't perceived. He wasn't a card-carrying, flag-waving socialist. He wasn't particularly communicative. He's a very shy person. And he kind of paid lip service. He wasn't the sporting role model that socialism wanted. Yeah, he was very, very good, very, very good. But he didn't play the game. He wasn't much interested in extolling the virtues of socialism at every turn.
Well, he gets the opportunity to defect, and he does. And we'll skip across that. But suffice to say that the effects on his family back home are severe and
yes.
Profound.
Yeah. It's an interesting thing, and the Berlin Wall, and the Berlin Wall, or the two Germanys. We tend, those of us that remember the Berlin Wall, we tend to view the defections, and there's a whole mythology built around the Berlin Wall, and the people that died trying to get across the Berlin Wall, or the inner German border, as it was known. And there's been a huge amount written, and there's a lot invested in it. We tend to perceive defections as a kind of escape to victory, yeah? And the notions that we might have is that you get to the other side in some way, and then everything's going to be okay because you've escaped socialism or whatever. But in point of fact, what you did, and what people did, and what Dieter did was you simply substituted one prison for another. He was the East Germany was, to all intents and purposes, a prison. You couldn't go west. But in defecting, in the first instance, he's got a choice. He has to make a decision between the girl that he loves and that he wants to be with, and the dream of riding the Tour de France, because the dream of riding the Tour de France was always present for these guys. The Tour de France was a professional race. It was the Tour de France. But in order so to do, he had to leave behind his family and his life, yeah, and his place and all of the things that had made him what he was. So, in effect, what he did, he made a decision to substitute the prison that was East Germany for the prison that was the West, which is very, very hard. He's never going to see... He's never going to see his parents again. He's never going to see his brother again. He's never going to see his friends again because he's not going to be welcomed back. The other element which I think we tend to overlook is that the Stasi, and the book obviously is called The Race Against the Stasi then visit hell upon the people that you leave behind. And there's a perfectly good reason for that. When high-profile people defected, it was a huge propaganda own goal, because what it said was, okay, capitalism is winning the argument. So when they went, and of course everybody knew that they went because they were famous people, it sent a clear message to the proletariat that capitalism actually was better. And of course people were defecting in droves prior to them building a wall, which informed the building of the wall. So then there's a whole process set in train, which is to repatriate them. And the way they did that would be to put severe pressure on the family left behind. and to communicate to Wiedemann, in effect, that if he didn't come back, this was just going to get worse and worse and worse. His family suffered a lot at the hands of the Stasi. Psychologically, they suffered a lot. His father lost his job. His brother lost his career. They became pariahs. And the object of the exercise is to convince Dieter to come back, because, of course, if Dieter comes back, they sell the idea that the West actually doesn't work at all. He's come back because he's figured out that socialism is far better than capitalism. So it's pretty brutal stuff, that. Yeah.
Did you ever get the impression that he regretted the decision to defect, or that he felt it was a bad decision?
I got the impression that it caused a colossal amount of pain. Every time we mentioned his father, and obviously this book took a lot of time and a lot of effort and a lot of pain. There was a lot of pain involved in making this book, for him particularly. Ultimately, he and Sylvia are still together, so, you know, 50 years on, they have three children, they built a life together, he rode the Tour de France, but he paid a huge, very heavy price, as did his family. So he was vindicated in the sense that he built a new life, but, you know, these people were compelled to choose, and it was hard, it was very hard.
And did he ever get a chance to be reconciled with them?
No, not really. 8 years on, there was a... they reopened the border, the German border in 1972. There was an amnesty, which in effect, in principle, meant that he could journey back. East Germany always needed cash, yeah, and so Western visitors basically deposited cash upon arrival. And in principle, Dieter was defection was high treason. It was a criminal act. It was probably the worst crime against socialism. But anyway, in 1972, he was able to go back, but it was broken. You know, he visited hell upon them. So still today, no relationship with the brother, with Eberhard. You can't really fix that. You know.
So 50 years later from all of this, you turn up on his doorstep. And what was that conversation like? First approach?
The first approach was bugger off, basically. You're kind of asking them to exhume something that's not probably going to be very nice. He'd never seen his Stasi file. Anyway, the first approach was no, not interested. Second approach was, okay, send me a list of questions for first, which I duly did. I sent a list of questions that I was minded to ask. And then we went, and we sat down one afternoon, and he started. And then once he started, that was it. It came. And astonishing photographic memory. Because, of course, he's falling in love. It's dramatic stuff, you know, the defection, the falling in love. It is. I mean, people have said it's very cinematic, the book, and it probably. And for him, it's very. The premise was I was writing a series of articles for Ruhr magazine about East German cycling at the time, and he was the last of the East German cyclists that I went to see, with a view to putting it in the magazine. But I thought I can't waste this in the magazine. I'm sure Ruhr is a nice magazine, but I didn't want to condense it into 1,000 words. And so I sat on it for a year and didn't publish it. And then I got the chance. Then the publisher asked me, and so we started.
Because the form of the book, for those of you who haven't read it, is that it's direct quotations of your interviews and their testimony, essentially.
Sure.
Unmediated by you. Clearly, it's been translated and edited and sequenced by you. But you don't take a role... a usual narratorial role in the text of the book. You would normally go about cross-referencing things that are being said, fact-checking things, getting different accounts of the same set of events. Were you able to do that with this book, or were you just going to put it down and let the reader decide?
I didn't want to write an interpretive text. I wanted his truth. And I wanted to try to put together, to try and also to understand the relationship between his truth and the prevailing conditions. And that was... So I didn't want to interpret what he said and what happened. I wanted to try to put this enormous jigsaw puzzle together as best I could. And I didn't want it to be conditional upon my ability to manipulate the language. I'd done cycling books before. So I wanted to try something different and something that I believe to be, or hopefully, is authentic.
You spoke to, obviously, Dieter and Sylvia, but you spoke to others.
Yeah.
And were there any moments where you heard directly contradictory stories from different people where it's not possible for both of them to be telling the truth?
No, not at all. Everything that he said was I was able to corroborate. Also with the party organ, because there were a lot of articles in the book from... So everything that he said chimed perfectly well, and that was astonishing. Because, of course, truth is always subjective and it's always deeply personal. And so there are stuff that he said that I thought, well, that doesn't actually... But everything that he said seemed to chime with the times and the prevailing conditions. There was a lot of work to be done in trying to understand what it was like to be in East Germany in the time. But no, it was... he's not capable of dissembling. He's just not that kind of guy.
And were there any mysteries or puzzles, things you didn't manage to solve, that are important to you?
Yeah, the book could have been 5,000 pages and not finished. Because it's like the Stasi particularly is like a huge spider's web. It never finishes, So, I mean, there are a lot of people that just refuse point blank to speak to me because you mentioned Dieter Wiedemann and they just shut up shop straight away because Dieter Wiedemann equates to the Stasi and socialism it has very negative connotations, what happened. I mean, there's a lot of... It's one of those things where you have to... I mean, it's a 400-page book, but it could have been a 4,000-page book, Jack, because you never get to the end with the Stasi. It's just a madness that you can never... The more you find out, the less you understand, and you can never solve it. So...
And you mentioned that he'd not seen his own Stasi file until you persuaded him to go to Berlin and do that, which must be a big decision for anyone who... Well, how many people have Stasi files?
I think everybody in the former East Germany has made that decision, at some point, whether or not to go. And it's quite interesting, actually, because a lot of East German citizens were very upset to discover they never had a Stasi file. They felt in some way belittled by never having been of sufficient import to warrant a Stasi file. At the outset, he said, no Stasi file. And then I went back and said, well, I'm going to do a book now, so it's kind of a non-negotiable for me. If we're going to do it, we're going to do it. I'm not going to play at it. And ultimately he agreed. Also, what happened was, very early in the piece, Sylvia, who was the girlfriend and now the wife and mother of the three daughters, developed breast cancer. So it looked for all the world like it was terminal. So it was time for them as well. I think they felt that it was time now to go and to do... so I wouldn't say it was apposite, but I suppose there are a number of factors came together. When we talk about Stasi file, a lot of people have several Stasi files, and he had four separate Stasi
files. And that's
files.
Filled with banal observations and horrific conspiracy from one page to the next.
Yeah, it's banality is obviously largely what makes it very so intriguing. Essentially, with him, at the point at which he defects, this whole mechanism starts to manoeuvre, and you've got hundreds of pages of tittle-tattle, nasty, vicious stuff. I mean, really, quite savage, which rubbishes him, rubbishes his family, portrays them as fascists, and sets out to get him back. Prior to his defection, actually, there's not that much in his Stasi file. It's basically a series of checks and balances. Is he a good socialism? Is he a good socialist? Do they vote on national holidays? Decorate the house with flags of Stalin and the national flag? Those kind of things. But upon his defection, all hell breaks loose.
And was he glad to have seen it? Was it cathartic, or did it just bring you all back
horrible.
In a horrible way? I mean, ultimately, obviously at the time. But,
it's horrible.
But did he wish he hadn't?
No, I don't think he's a very intelligent guy, and he understood that it was implicit and it was necessary for the book. But there's all sorts of stuff in there from people that... I always cite this as an example of just how pervasive the Stasi was and how dysfunctional this society became very, very quickly. There's one particular informant that speaks of Dieter always, if it always makes reference to Dieter, his friend. Because, of course, Dieter's a bit of a celebrity. He's finished third in the peace race, which is a big thing. Yeah, it's a big, important thing. He's a famous sportsman. This guy doesn't make any distinction and doesn't seem to understand the implicit kind of contradiction between claiming Dieter as his friend but whilst simultaneously informing upon him. Now, for us, that's just weird, isn't it? That's not right. Yeah, I mean, very obviously, it's morally, it's... So that was strange. And, of course, Dieter then, after all these years, is confronted by people whom he believed to have been his friends. He discovered that his coaches at the sports club were Stasi. Everybody in a position of authority in the sporting structure was Stasi. By definition, you had to be. You couldn't not be. If you wanted to get on, you were charged with... You were administering to the needs of these athletes, these cyclists. So you had to be ideologically sound. So, yeah, it's a can of worms. It's really,
And so within the seeds of what went on to become the East German sporting miracle in all kinds of sports, particularly, I think, track and field is what we think about it most often, and some of those world records still stand, I think,
yeah,
don't they?
Right, yeah.
We can see how a ruthless and entirely invasive state apparatus that it sees sport as very important for its own sense of prestige at home and abroad.
Yeah.
It's going to lead to somewhere very dark, isn't it?
Yeah, they were. It was rooted the East German sports miracle, and maybe some of you remember the swimmers, the girls in the '70s, where they just 76 Olympics, where a country of 17 million people. Was second in the medal table behind the Soviet Union. Phenomenally successful. State-administered anabolic steroid program. Teenage girls mutating into boys. Horrific things. Corporal damage, psychological damage. Awful things. But of course, sport was... They were diplomats in tracksuits. And they used sport as a diplomatic tool, you know. And that was rooted in bike racing. Because they through the peace race, they understood the value of sport, not only in engendering patriotism at home, but in actually delivering de facto legitimacy on the state. So that's one of the great legacies of the great legacies. Anything but great. That's one of the legacies of the peace race.
I mean, and can we say we've left that world entirely behind us?
No, you can't. You never can, because of course we've left behind. The state sponsored this massive state-sponsored and orchestrated doping program that one would like to think doesn't exist anymore. But no.
But we still have.
We have Mo Farah presumably is funded from somewhere.
Yeah, we still have all these national academies, which are very much like
Absolutely.
What they were setting up in
Precisely,
the German Democratic Republic.
We
have the medal table in the Olympics as the preeminent metric. Of how
Precisely.
Good the Olympics is going. We don't look at sport as the contest. We look at how well our people are doing against their people. Maybe it's always been like that, but it doesn't seem like we're getting any further away from that, even if we are living in a post-ideological age.
I think if we think even of the success of British cycling at this time and this extraordinary wave... It's informed to a significant degree by the track success that we had, yeah? So Chris Hoy and Pendleton and Wiggins and Kyle, all of these people. And they were cheap medals because nobody rode the track. No national cycling federation funded the track. So in the same way that you know, Nordic sports are very big in Norway because they always win, yeah, and so it perpetuates, it's because nobody else doing it. Yeah. It's the way the thing works, isn't it? See, it's very, very broadly speaking, but that in essence is
yeah, all the rowing and yeah, the sailing exactly, yeah. And all the ones that you have to have a lot of carbon fibre and sitting down.
Yeah.
We'll do well if we throw money at it.
But yeah, they throw money at it. And the more money you throw at it, the more chances you're going to have of winning gold medals. That's just it's pretty straightforward algorithm.
I should open the discussion up to everyone here. Who's got a question for Herbie? Or we can just keep chatting away. But we've got a roving mic, I think, as well.
I was wondering, Herbie, you mentioned it's quite cinematic. Have you had any approaches for it possibly being made into a film? He asks as a bike film festival curator.
Somebody, a very famous director, asked for a copy of it, but I suspect he wants to use it as a doorstop. No, Tommy, no, sadly. Writing these books, financially, they're a disaster, these things. You know, you do this stuff, and it's madness, because they just cost you money. You know? And so the dream of every writer, with the exception of a few writers, you know, that can make a good living from writing, is that the prayer is that somebody's going to make a film. But, of course, it never happens. In reality, it's one in a million, I suppose.
Could I follow up that on... I don't know whether you've listened to the Serial podcast that was the sort of big podcast success of last year. Did you listen to that at all? Hear about it? It's called Serial, and it was clearly not. Anyone here listen to Serial? Okay, it's the idea of the podcast was that it was reopening a cold case kind of thing, like or a miscarriage of justice. I think it was, but it's it had become a sort of cold case of a murder. And the journalist is trying to find out, did they bang up the wrong guy or not? And so it's a lot of interviews with the person who they did bang up and everybody else around about the time of the murder, digging away. And you listen to it all, like, week to week in real time as the reporter's doing the investigation. People loved it. It was hugely successful. And I think people love the idea of going behind the scenes in journalism and getting kind of behind the eyes of the writer, rather than receiving a finished book at the end of it, of here's what I think and here's the end. It struck me that this book was a sort of, it had a lot of parallels with that approach, that you've done these interviews, you've accessed the Stasi files, you've reproduced them in translation in the kind of ersatz format, but you give the reader the feeling that they are doing the interviews and they are poring over these documents. And that is something that is quite unusual. And I think it might be something that is going to be the way things are going to go, or certainly a new type of writing. Is it a new type of writing, and do you think would you do that sort of approach again, or was it very specific to this?
I like it. I must admit, I like another reason that I decided to use this sort of methodology is that there was a very famous, a guy called Peter Taylor had used this interview technique. And I'd read some of his books. He'd written a book about the troubles in Belfast about 20 years ago. And all he'd done, effectively, is a very good researcher. He'd just gone and interviewed people. And collectively, these interviews, and he'd done the same thing in the Soviet Union and during the miners' strike. Very, very good writer. Evidently a brilliant researcher. But he just created this mosaic, you know. And I like that as an idea. I just read a book about Gino Bartoli, actually, if I'm honest, when I started this, and it was rubbish, this thing. Because the whole thing was, like, predicated on a big lie, the myth of Gino Bartoli.
And is I this thought, the Road to Valour?
Yeah, yeah. And I just thought, I can't
Sorry,
actually
Road
subscribe.
To Valour authors.
I can't subscribe to this anymore, because the whole thing was nonsense. Yeah. And I wanted to do something that wasn't that, you know. I wanted to do something where... You can never find, and there is no truth. This probably isn't absolute, but I wanted to try and discover a different way to do it, and hopefully, only through speaking to human beings can you discover any semblance of truth. Yeah, and so it is and remains the first time a Stasi file has ever been reproduced in English. Amazingly, even, you know, Anna Funder's famous, very famous book called Stasi Land by Anna Funder. Tim Garton Ash has written books. Gary Bruce has written books about the Stasi, but nobody's ever reproduced a Stasi file before in English, and I thought it was, and I like that as an idea. I wanted to do that.
And so when you go to try and come back with something worthwhile and useful from an interview, how do you set about achieving a successful interview with someone, particularly if they're maybe a little bit reluctant to talk?
I think I don't profess to be a particular expert as an interviewer, but I think it's important that you do your homework as best you can and they understand that you're interested and that you're really bothered about what you're doing. I think once they... I mean, there are certain ways to deal with certain people, and I've interviewed an awful lot of cyclists down the years, obviously, and some are more forthcoming than others, but I think it's very important that they understand that you're serious, about your work, with anybody, any work that you do. So in this instance, it was important, particularly with Teve Shaw, who was the big idol, as I say, it was important. He remains a committed communist, and so it was very important that he understood that I had done my homework, that I wasn't just going to go there and flatulate around, you know, his success on the bike. So you kind of got to try and hopefully do the job seriously and do the research, you know, put the work in beforehand. I had a real problem with Dieter's brother. Dieter really didn't want me to go and interview his brother. That was horrific. Dieter's brother, younger brother, Eberhard, was a very talented cyclist, a very, very talented cyclist by all accounts, junior national champion, and probably even more talented than Dieter. And, of course, when Dieter defected at a stroke, his career finished. Now, this was a 18-year-old kid. And all he was, and anybody that's ever ridden a bike seriously, the bike becomes who you are, how you identify yourself. We are, you know, cycling people are conditioned by the bike. And Eberhard, the only thing that he wanted was to be a cyclist. The only thing that he wanted was to emulate his brother who'd ridden the Peace Race. The only thing their father wanted was to see his two boys ride the Peace Race together. But in point of fact, what happened was that Dieter left and his father was ruined.
Yeah. Nick?
Just going to ask about how the West perceived Dieter when he defected. So were they like suspicious of him, or and also just how successful he was? I mean, did he make a good living in the West, and how did he do in the tour? Did he?
It was interesting in the West because the Stasi had plants all over the West. The Stasi were everywhere. And he told me a story, and again it's in the book, about the BND. The BND was the West German Ministry for State Security. And he got a knock on the door one day, fairly early on. So he defected in July of 64. And I think that autumn he got a knock on the door one night, and two officials from the BND wanted to question him, yeah? So he let them in and they asked him lots of questions. And I think it happened twice. I think there were two separate occasions where the BND ostensibly came to his house and asked him questions. And during the writing of the book, I went to the BND files and they have no recollection. They didn't. So these were Stasi people masquerading as BND. And all through the book... In his West German life, his movements are reported quite meticulously. So today, Wiedemann had a meeting with a team manager from Holland. Yeah. So the Stasi were all over him in the West as well, the point is. As regards his cycling career otherwise, he rode the Tour de France. He was there when Simpson rode himself to death on Ventoux in 67. He rode the Tour once. He was good. He finished 10th in the Tour of Switzerland. He got round the Tour, and the Tour back then was much harder. Final penultimate stage was 380 kilometres, I think. He was good. He was never a champion. He was never going to be a champion. But the money ran out, and the team that he was riding for folded in 67 after he'd ridden the Tour. And to cut a very long story short, he was able to earn far more money working in a factory than being a professional cyclist. So his professional cycling career was 3 years, in effect. But he rode the Tour. And people that rode the Tour and finished the Tour back then, given that it was pretty biblical back then, they defined themselves through having ridden the Tour. And it's very important to him, his Tour de France, his having got round, you know. So, yeah, he wasn't a champion, but he was decent.
I just had a curiosity question, really. Was there a women's peace race? Were women allowed to race in the peace race? And did you get a sense of what women's cycling was like behind the Iron Curtain?
I don't think there was a women's peace race. As far as, to the best of my knowledge, there may have been, but track cycling certainly was quite big in the Soviet bloc. But, you know, it wasn't quite as evolved, shall we say, as today. So they weren't particularly famous champions. There was no Voss, there was no Nicole Cook, you know, they didn't... But, yeah, they rode.
I very much enjoyed the book, and particularly the bits about Stasi and the bits about the peace race. But there's quite a lot there reproducing his letters to Sylvia, and I found that very difficult and just a bit too personal. Did you have any sort of issues about putting that in, or your sort of feelings about putting that in there?
No. I didn't have any issues with it per se. I had issues... The only issues that I had that he was actually quite selective in what he gave me. He didn't give me them all. So they're all there, you know, a lot of them, because they wrote for 4 years, obviously. The only editing that Dieter did, actually, was that he didn't give me all of the letters, thankfully, because I'd have never finished the bloody book. I thought they were implicit and intrinsic to the book. You know, they were part of. They informed what happened in their lives, and so.
I mean, if you're not convinced by the love story, then the whole defection takes a very different colour, doesn't it?
It's interesting because, you know, they're still together all these years on.
Well, they have to be, don't they?
Yeah, of course. But by the same token, he had somewhere to go in the West because there was Sylvia. So they'd only met twice. When he defected, they'd only met twice. Once in 1960 when there were kids, and once in 63 when she'd come over for a family, she'd been given a permit. She was able to come over once because he was a famous peace race rider, so he got special treatment, so she was able to come over. But, it's interesting because he wanted to be with Sylvia, but he also wanted to ride the Tour de France. Because the dream of athletes in the East was to ride with a name on the jersey, with the team cars, because obviously those things existed on the other side, and that was a world they couldn't touch. It made it all the more attractive, yeah. So, to some degree, you can never say that Sylvia was an instrument, but the fact that she was there, if you like, made it feasible for him to go. So you could never say he was opportunistic at all, because he's not that kind of person, but he had somewhere to go, and he had a place to take shelter in the West, literally to hide in the West. So there was an element of that as well. I think they were in love in a very kind of abstract kind of way, because they'd only really written letters. But, you know, it's what it is.
Yeah, question over there.
Hi. Two questions, if I can, cheating. Firstly, if his family had been more regular party-carrying members, would they have been treated differently after he defected? That's one about how the family might have been treated. And then the other is, out of curiosity about the peace race, I get the impression it must have been quite tough because the roads weren't much copper. I was on the road from Prague to Berlin in about 1971, I think, and sections of it were still cobbled.
No, somebody has to pay, yeah. Somebody has to pay because of what he did. I think they would have suffered anyway, because, of course, for the Stasi, they were interested in establishing whether or not they had knowledge of his intention to defect. And so what they do is they set out with a certain narrative, and the narrative is to get him back, yeah. And to get him back, they're going to make their life hell. And so what they do is they then they scrutinise their character, or in effect they rubbish the character of the family, and his having defected he's having betrayed socialism, was largely informed by his lack of education, his parents' inability to educate him, their lack of conviction, if you will, their ideological bankruptcy. I don't know is the simple answer, but I think the fact that he had defected was a testimony to the fact that they were ideologically bankrupt. So they're going to suffer. Because if they brought him up to be a good socialist, which was their obligation to socialism, of course he wouldn't have defected in the first instance. As regards the roads, yeah, I mean, I interviewed Ian Steele, who won the 1952 peace race. And there were frames breaking all over the place, yeah. I mean, the roads were... It's great, the peace race is great. I think, purely as a bike race, it's not particularly tactical, because you've got guys from all over the world. You've got Finnish guys who can't really ride, and you've got these super champions from Russia and Poland and East Germany. Yeah, I think it was pretty hardcore stuff, the peace race. It was 2 weeks, not three. It wasn't as long as the Tour. And, of course, it wasn't as mountainous as the Tour. But I think the peace race mutated into other things, and it became a political football and all the rest of it. But actually, if you think about it, the idea of disparate cyclists from all over the world coming together to deliver this message of peace to these devastated populations is really beautiful. I think it's something really beautiful, the peace race. I think we probably could do with a peace race today.
Well, we've not got to go anywhere, so if you want to chat to Herbie afterwards or buy a book and have him sign it for you, you'll be happy to that, will you? All that remains for me to do is to ask you to join me in thanking Herbie for coming and talking to us about his terrific book. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Jack.
I was in conversation with Herbie Sykes, and his book, The Race Against the Stasi, is published by Aurum Press. Thanks for listening, and until next time on The Bike Show, goodbye.